Talkback with Gary Null, Sundays at 8 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Lots on health and nutrition today. No hard-hitting commentaries and no in-depth guest. We're going to be talking about things that cause us to better understand life, to heal. And I want to thank all of you who showed up today in Washington, D.C. for the culmination of a long march, 316 miles from New York City, from Prospect Park, where we started 2 weeks ago, to Lafayette Park across from the White House, protesting genetic engineering. If the American public could vote tomorrow on whether they wanted food labeled as genetically engineered or not, it would be unanimous. Everyone that was spoken to on the street, people just casually walking by, asked questions. What do you think of genetic engineered food? Would you want it? Would you want a Franken food? No, they didn't. And of course, all the people who were there who made that sacrifice. So thank you all very much. Starting off today, can't buy me love. Study shows materialistic couples have more money and more problems. This is from Science Daily and the Journal of Couple and Relationship Therapy. It says this: new research confirms the Beatles' lyrical hypothesis and finds that the kind of thing that money just can't buy is a happy, stable relationship. Scholars at Brigham Young University studied 1,700 married couples across the United States. Each couple went into depth about what they value, and having money and lots of things was a part of that. Researchers' statistical analysis showed that couples who say money is not important to them score about 15% better on relationship sustainability and other measures of relationship quality than couples where one or both are materialistic. Quote, couples where both spouses are materialistic were worse off on nearly every measure we looked at. There was a perverse pattern in the data of eroding communications, poor conflict resolution, and low responsiveness to each other. So, look at it another way. I remember once my mother telling me that during the Great Depression, she was a young teenager, and her five sisters and four brothers lived over in a place called Little Hocking, Ohio, across the Ohio River from where she grew up in Parkersburg, because it was a place where there was a farm, and my great aunt had the farm, and they all lived there. And they had to work hard, because my great aunt was a disciplinarian. I mean, she got up early and she did all of her chores. Now, here was a wiry, dynamic woman that you would see milking the goats, milking the cows, milking the sheep. She'd be churning the butter. She'd be making the cheeses. She'd be going to the beehive and getting the bee propolis to make sure a little bit of bee propolis went in each morning into the porridges so they wouldn't get sick. She would also hang all the cheeses in the barn. She would dry the food. As a kid, I remember out there, I'd be sitting there cutting apples and then splitting the apples in half, taking the seeds out, saving the seeds, and then laying the apples on a screen with a muslin cloth over top so the insects didn't get to it, and about 4 days later, you'd have a dried apple. She did it with peaches and pears. She must have 15 types of pears, at least 30 types of apples, several types of peaches. She had plums, and she made prunes from the plums. She had grapes. She made raisins from the grapes. I remember there was a time when I went into her root cellar, and the root cellar was about 8 foot underground, and it was all brick walls and brick floor, and it was cool. Now, it was surprising because it was in the early fall, and it was about 75 degrees outside, but when I walked down those steps, it dropped about 25 degrees. It was about 55 degrees, and that's what happens in a root cellar. When you're about 8 feet below ground and you have a room, it's going to be cool. In any case, that's where she had these bins. And these big bins were all a lay of... She would take bee propolis, and she would take an oil. I never knew what kind of oil it was, but she would wipe the insides of these down, and that kept the bacteria and molds from growing. And then she had these big kegs, kind of kegs that you used to see, big pickles, you know, pickle barrel. And these would be stacked with, just packed with different types of fruits. And at one time, I believe there was around 70 different types of items in these. And all this came from about a 140-acre farm. Everything was growing all the time. And she also had nut trees, walnut trees. And she had... She would also grow in this one garden all of the herbs. And that was called the apothecary garden. And she would grow the herbs and then put them in little brown bags and tie them upside down in the barn. And they'd be up there for a long period of time. And then one day I walked in, and the entire top of the barn, you couldn't see the wood and the beams because she had all these little bags. And on the outside of the bag would be a marker. And it'd tell you what was in there. And she was so knowledgeable that in the late fall, early winter, my mother and her sisters would take down the bags, and then they would take these and they would put them in, depending upon what part was usable. Was it the stem, the bark, the leaf? And they would put them into jars and then label the jars. And then they put them in the room, and my mother said there were hundreds of bottles in there. So no matter what a person needed, it was gotten for a cold or flu or infection or mosquito bite or poison ivy. But also, my aunt, great aunt, would go in there and put this stuff in the food that she was making. She believed, much like the Chinese, that you include healing herbs in the dishes you're making. That way, you're always preventing something. And anyhow, it was quite a remarkable environment, but not unique and not original. That's the way most of the earlier farmers, homesteaders, and pioneers lived. They didn't have monoculture. If you wanted to go broke, you ended up with monoculture. But before you went broke, you made a lot of money. A person would come in and say, look, you have 130 acres here. What are you growing? Well, we're growing about 300 different things. We have barley, and we have millet, and we have rye, and we have wheat, and we have rice all growing here. That's the grains. And we have 50 types of beans growing here. And then we have all these fruit trees and apple trees and nut trees and all these different beehives. And we have all these sheep over here and goats over there and cows over there. We do the milk. We do the cheeses. And a person says, that's a lot of work. Don't do any of that. We're going to give you a guarantee $3 for a bushel of corn. No matter how good or bad anything else is, you're going to get that. So now you're going to plant 100 acres of just corn. Well, okay. So that seemed good to a lot of people. Gee whiz, you didn't have to do all this work all the time. So people started growing a single crop, wheat or corn, and they started doing this, and as a result, the person that used to make their own bread now had to go to the store to get the bread. The person used to have chickens, so they had their own eggs. Now they could go to the store and buy their eggs. Had their own cows? No, now they didn't have any cows. So they went to the store to buy their milk. So now the things that used to make them self-sufficient and sustainable and reliable, they didn't have. But they had that check came in when the crop came in. They get that check. But over a period of time, the corn caused the nitrogen in the soil to be depleted. There was nothing put on the soil in the wintertime, so when the ground froze and the snow was everywhere, in the spring when the ground started to thaw, major cracks and fissures appeared in the soil, and when the runoff occurred, the good quality topsoil ran off. Thousands of pounds per farm went right into the creeks and the rivers and ended up as silt further down, let's say in the Ohio River, Kanawha River, Mississippi River, Missouri River. It ended up somewhere just building up on the bottom of a place. Now what you had is you had farm equipment breaking down. You had high expenses. And you weren't self-sufficient. And then along came the Great Dust Bowl. Man-made. Because they didn't take care of the soil. They over-farmed it. Over-exploited it. And that's how we got into a lot of trouble. Well, on my aunt's farm, they didn't do that. They would always put down a cover crop. And the best cover crop was soybeans. So they would take soybeans and plant it in the late fall. It would come up and it would cover the ground. And then in the spring, they would plow it under, and that became the fertilizer and nourishment for the next summer crop. In effect, you were feeding the soil. A completely different way of looking at land. Yes, it was more labor-intensive. But as my mother said, it was very rewarding. But also, there was time every day for reading and writing. My aunt wanted to insist that everyone knew at least two languages and was highly articulate and intelligent. And that's what they did. So aside from everything else, she also did her own little red schoolhouse for all my mother's brothers and sisters and my father's brothers and sisters. So there was a whole lot of people there. And my mother reported one story that really stuck in her mind. She said that one day she was told she had to get up early at 3 o'clock in the morning. Why 3 o'clock? Well, because there was going to be a train that was going to stop at 6, and now, this was a non-official stop. Some of the conductors knew that there were farmers along their way that actually had a little extra food or clothing or something to give the people who were homeless that were on the boxcars. And not all trains had what were called hobos, and people just didn't have a home going from point A to point B, hoping it would be better, but it wasn't. Everywhere you went in America at that point, it was bad. But there were some very spiritual conductors who knew, okay, I can stop here for only 2 minutes because we can't be late. If we're late, then they're going to know that I'm stopping someplace and they're going to fire me. So it was real fast. And so there were picnic tables set up. And whatever they had, my aunt said, give half of our food that we have today to strangers. You don't have that today. That was the ethic. That was the morality. That was the way people lived. And it wasn't unique to my great aunt. This was something that all across America people grew up with, a sense of community, a sense of sharing, helping someone else, helping a stranger. So on that particular day, my mother, who didn't want to get up at that early, she goes down there and they're making sandwiches and making things people could take with them. And they would also go to a local place, and there was a collective, and it worked out on my great aunt's farm. They would get broken lamps and radios and anything broken, and they would fix it because it was free to get and just took time and a little labor to fix. And then they would offer them to people. So now you had something you could sell, and then they would sell these, and then they would also take clothing. And they would patch clothing and patch and sew. My mother used to spend the evenings patching and sewing stuff. So they would take shirts, blouses, dresses, whatever they had down, and they would make stacks of it. The men's clothes on one table, the women's clothes on another table. And then they would put sizes because they knew it had to be fast. So someone would get off a train and sudden boom, boom, they had to go and get their, whatever was available. And so first time my mom did this, there was food on the table. The train stopped, door opened up, and about 7 people got off. One woman and 6 guys. And what they did first, before they came over to see what was available for them, they tried to make themselves presentable. My mother's watching this. And here's a guy combing his hair, and he straightened his tie, and he wiped his shoes off. My mom turns to my grand-aunt and says, "Why is he doing that?" My grand-aunt said, "He may be poor, but he has self-esteem." Now think of that. Think of that. You don't have a nickel. You don't know where you're going. You have no home. You're really having a rough time. But you still want to make yourself presentable to strangers. Stuck in my mom's head. And I thought, wow, what lessons we can gain from those who've come before us about compassion, understanding, putting yourself in another person's shoes. What does it mean? And my mother also learned that one of the joys she had was watching people share what they were given. If we didn't have enough, my mom said, they would actually, on their own, share what they had with others. You wouldn't have that today. Not in a heartbeat. So the greatest generation, those who were born or lived during the Great Depression and survived, were stronger because of it and understood some principles of life that many of us today would benefit from knowing. But my mother said the most important thing at the time was respecting the family and respecting that what was important in life was not the materialism or money you had, but rather what held you together when you didn't have it. And that's what created lifelong bonds. Now think of today, the millionaire dating site and the people who are given tens of thousands of dollars to match them up with the right person. And then when you see the criteria, how rich are they? What economics do they have? Because that's what I want. Why do you want that? Why don't you just go earn your own money? Why do you want to live through someone else's money? And what are you going to give in return? Sex? Well, that's not a good exchange. That's going to wear all thin. Then what are you left with? What do you really have in common then? What if you took money out of the equation completely and then started? What then would you have? And there was a time when that was important because people just didn't have money. In fact, from 1929 through 1945, it's a long period of time, people just didn't have material possessions. So you valued everything, but more importantly, you valued family. You valued your relationship. You valued your friendships. You valued your community. So when I read a study like I just read, there's a whole lot that we can learn from that. Next up, how to heal cavity naturally and nutritionally without the need for drilling and filling, from Ethan Up, National News. Let me quote this. He says, having a dentist drill out a tooth and fill it with composite, ceramic, or toxic amalgam is not the only way to deal with one's cavity. Sarah Pope, a mother in nutrition education and chapter leader for the Weston Price Foundation, tells the story on her blog of how her young son's cavity was completely healed through one simple dietary as well as supplement contribution of two powerful healing oils. When Sarah's husband first noticed the deep crater on the side of their son's lateral incisor tooth, the couple immediately decided to call the dentist and schedule an appointment to have it filled. Though familiar with the nutritional protocols for healing tooth cavities naturally, Sarah and her husband decided that the cavity was too severe and that the best course of action was to have it filled as soon as possible in order to prevent it from rotting completely. But since the first appointment was scheduled for several weeks away, Sarah decided to instruct her son to go through with a natural tooth healing protocol anyway. This included giving him daily raw butter and honey on two pieces of toast and supplementing with a teaspoon of fermented cauliflower oil, three capsules a day. According to Sarah's account, her son had already been eating tahini and honey on toast every day, as well as consuming cauliflower oil, but she decided to simply switch out his tahini for raw butter and add butter oil to his daily dose of fermented cauliflower oil. a synergistic combination long held by Dr. Weston Price as a highly therapeutic nutritional healing treatment. However, just one day before her son's appointment, Sarah received a call from the dentist's office notifying her that Dennis had to make a sudden out-of-town trip and the appointment would have to be rescheduled for another few weeks out. So Sarah's son continued the raw butter and butter oil routine during that time, and what happened is saw his cavity vanish completely. That's interesting. Haven't heard of that therapy before. Meditation nourishes the brain. I'll quote this. This was published in the Journal of Neuroscience, as reported by Dave Gabriel of Natural News. It says, "What is it about meditation that invokes so much mystery? When asked, people conjure images of difficult lotus positions, strange beliefs, and exotic settings. Of course, none of that is necessary, and the realities of a person sitting comfortably on their living room floor for a few minutes isn't quite as interesting. Confounding public perception even more are the religious connotations that are sometimes concocted to set around meditation. This only serves to further alienate people who could potentially benefit. This is unfortunate, since it can easily be argued that prayer in any religion is a form of meditation. The practice of meditation has a long history in almost every major historical civilization and religion, yet there is so much that is not known. When we look at the past philosophies and beliefs associated with meditation, we can understand the perceptions of the ancients according to contemporary science. Science has not replaced the old views. So far, it has mostly served to strengthen many of the ancient beliefs. However, modern science has been able to fill in some essential details of underlying processes. It's been shown that meditation can increase pain tolerance. One study published in the Journal of Neuroscience showed that meditation caused a 40% lowering of pain intensity and a 57% lowering of pain unpleasantness. That is impressive when you consider that morphine and other pain-relieving drugs only lower symptoms of pain by 25%. This relief came from subjects with no previous meditation experience who were taught basic meditation in a total of 4 20-minute classes. Now, a number of studies that have utilized modern imaging technology, such as MRI, have clearly shown that meditation increases blood flow to the brain and, with extended practice, actually makes significant changes to the brain's physical structure. These changes can lead to increased efficiency and function in certain parts of the brain, such as heightened visuospatial processing and increased focus. A Harvard Medical School study put subjects on a 2-month course of meditation and then used MRI to compare the brains of the meditators with the average brain. The results showed that the subjects had increased gray matter density in the brain regions involved in learning and memory processes and emotional regulation and self-referential processing and perspective taking. A 2010 University of Pennsylvania Medical Center study using SPEC, which is single photon emission computerized tomography, to map out the differences in blood flow in the brain between a person who's meditating regularly and a person who does not meditate at all, specific regions of the brain were found to have more blood flow than those of the average person. Meditation can also foster positive emotions and give practitioners an increased ability to deal with emotions in general, such as stress and anxiety. A 2009 study published in NeuroImage from UCLA used MRI to compare long-time meditators with novices. In the veteran meditators, they found significant larger gray matter volume in the right orbital frontal cortex, the right thalamus, and the right hippocampus. And all these areas are important for emotional regulation and response. Thus, larger volumes in these regions might account for meditators' singular abilities and habits to cultivate positive emotions, retain emotional stability, and engage in mindful behavior. And the latest research shows that meditation is able to increase the ability of attention and self-awareness. So my suggestion is meditation high up on our list of things to do. separately from Science Daily, how the brain's own marijuana-like chemicals suppress pain. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Pain. The new findings about how the brain functions to suppress pain have been published just recently, and for the first time it has been shown that the hippocampus of the brain, which is usually associated with memory, has an active role to play in suppressing pain during times of stress. The work was carried out by the researchers at Pharmacology and Therapeutics and the Center for Pain Research, the National Center for Biomedical Research in Galway. So now we know that when you're meditating, you're actually allowing the release of chemicals in the brain that act like marijuana in reducing pain. And finally on this area, violent games, which are almost all the games now, emotionally desensitize the person. This is from Biological Psychology, as published in Science Daily. Quote, after exclusively violent events, and excessively violent events, shoot-'em-up games regularly come under scrutiny. In Norway, several first-person shooter games disappeared from the market for a while after the killings. Does intense fighting on a flat-screen display also result in aggressive behavior in real life? Researchers from the University of Bonn found brain activity patterns in heavy gamers that differ from those of non-gamers. And the study's results have just been published in Biological Psychology. Quote, first-person shooter games have been discussed in connection with violence over and over. Participants take on the role of a shooting person shooting your opponents in a warlike situation using different weapons. The Norwegian killer is said to have participated in such worlds intensely before he killed dozens of people in Oslo's government district and on the island of Utøya. And after the shooting sprees, the debate whether violent games lower the inhibition threshold and result in violent behavior was revived. Psychologists and neurologists from the University of Bonn studied the effects of shoot-'em-up game images and other emotionally charged photos on the brain activity of heavy game players. Quote, compared to the people who abstain from first-person shooters, they show clear differences in how emotions are controlled. Which means that if you're a person that plays these violent games over and over, you're actually changing your brain chemistry and it's desensitizing you to violence in real life. And think of all the people who are now engaged regularly in watching violence. There's a whole lot of videos up that on people that go out and fight each other. Women who fight each other, and men who fight each other, and people who go out and fight strangers and beat up hobos and homeless people. And these are very popular. Why in the world would any reasonable person want to see people just hurt each other? And part of it is now, because we see that violent games that people grow up on emotionally desensitize you to the reality of what it is. Now, then, could it also be extended? And this is just a hypothetical question. Could it also be said that in our society, if you come from a privileged background, does it desensitize you from people who are coming from a struggling background? If you're so used to having everything, you have air conditioning in the summer, you have heat in the winter, you have car to get you everywhere, you have money to buy things, you have credit when you want it, you have all the clothes you want, you have a packed schedule, you're always engaged in some kind of exuberant activity. Does that in any way desensitize you to people who each day wake up and don't have enough food for themselves or their family, don't have a knowledge, will they be able to sleep in this place much longer, will they lose their home and be couch surfing? I'm asking it as a question. I'll say my thoughts on what I believe the answer is, but it's something I'd like for you to think about. Because I'm in one of those unusual positions. Unlike most people, the pundits on television, as a therapist, I have a chance to counsel people, and I counsel people every single day. Tens of thousands of people. And some are the most powerful business, celebrity, athlete, people in the world. I never break their confidences, but I can tell you this. Without their entourages, and without their publicists, without their gatekeepers that protect them, you would have no idea how terrified these people are of having you know how just ordinary they are. It reminds me of something that happened just about 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I received a call from a friend of mine, and he said, Gary, could you do me a favor? And I said, sure, Steve, what? He said, I'm a part of a large group of people who are meeting down in the Bahamas, and the whole issue is the future of the health movement. And I thought, who better to talk about this than you? And I said, who are the people? He said, these are money managers. These are people who manage the money of the most powerful, wealthy people in the world. For example, the top Russian money manager. He manages monies for over a dozen oligarchs. He probably controls over $100 billion. And he's not even the most significant one. This man from Japan that no one would ever know, very quiet man, very blissful man, he manages the money for the top financial industrialists in Japan. And there are going to be 22 of these money managers there. So if you could come tomorrow, and I was just that day lecturing in Las Vegas, I said, okay, because I was going to go back to my home, so I just made an extra stop, and boom, next morning, I'm in the Bahamas. And so I go to this place, and I get there mid-morning, and they're in this man's house. It was the strangest house I've ever seen in my life. It was a tree house, and they're all sitting around, and there are about 22 of them, and they want to know about where is the future of health going. Now, I'm going to talk about this after our break. So I think you'll find this interesting because this ties in to our larger topic that I was just discussing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Boston for the springtime. I'm staying here with some friends and they've got lots of room. And you can sell your paintings on the sidewalk. Buy a cafe where I hope to be.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. So anyhow, to continue with this, because I think it's instructive. So here I was in a room with a group of individuals who managed the personal fortunes of some of the wealthiest people in the world. And collectively in there, it was in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And so first they picked my brains, and I told them what I thought about the health of the world and individual countries and where we were going with our health education systems, how to make people healthier. And so that answered their questions. But then I started to ask them in private conversations throughout the day and evenings about themselves and the clients whose money they managed. And two things were particularly instructive for me. And I look for the little things that tell me a lot about a person. We were jogging down the road on this island. And as we were jogging past some workers, I asked, were there about three of us jogging together, I asked one of the guys, I said, what are your feelings about people who maintain people's lawns here and do their cooking and cleaning, the service personnel? How do you look at these people? And I said, no more. And they had become desensitized that these were actual people who had families, and what money you gave them had to go a long way because they had so little. And they had no sense that these were actual people. They were merely objects. So later that day, I said, could I entertain a topic that we could discuss for a moment? And they said, sure. And I said, what about becoming desensitized to the needs of other people if you have to make a decision on how to make money for yourself or your clients And if making that money meant that other people would be deprived of some quality of life, food, water, a quality employment, does that matter? Does that come into your consciousness? Do you care about other people? And one of them said, well, why is that important? I said, well, for the average American, since 1976, if you adjust for the inflation and the cost of merchandise, we have had flat, zero growth in the average person's income. And then I explained, and mind you, these are money managers, economists, people from Yale and Harvard and Stanford and the Wharton School of Business. These are all the top, best, and brightest. But I'm explaining something that seemed to have caught them off guard. I said, when I was growing up, and I'm sure when many of you were growing up, your parents were able to afford just all the basic things you needed and have some savings left over. In fact, by the 1960s, the average American family saved about 13%. And my father was didn't make much money, but we always had savings. And we didn't really want for anything. And we had hand-me-downs, of course, because they came out of the Great Depression. That was just part of the mindset. They didn't want us, the baby boomers' children, they didn't want us to suffer or to be deprived as they were. Because a lot of them saw death, a lot of them saw starvation, a lot of them saw massive suffering. Part of their psyche was, I won't have my children go with what I went through. All right, we understand that. But then I said, do you remember mass poverty in the late 40s and 50s and 60s? No. Do you remember long food lines of average Americans, working Americans? No. Do you remember how many Americans in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s and 70s had to have two jobs in order just to pay their bills? No. Do you remember having tens of thousands of dollars in student loans when you got out of college? Or did you remember getting out of college and having no loans and being able to find work almost immediately? In fact, having more people want us than there were those of us graduating to fill those jobs. Yeah. Okay, just perspective. Now, that was because there were, for 100 years, capitalism, the system that we're all part of today, at one end of it or another, had one very important hallmark. There was a greater demand for workers than there were workers to fill the jobs. As a result, an incentive was continue to pay people better wages. And by paying them better wages, you would get good workers, and you would also, you didn't have the unemployment, you didn't have the indebtedness. Corporations weren't indebted, the government wasn't indebted except for the Second World War. But there was growth, constant growth. Now, there were sections of our society that did not prosper. There was segregation. There was, in the 1800s, child labor. There was a lot of impoverishment within different groups. But as a whole, because of the collective bargaining, because of the unions, because of women's equality in the workplace, wages went up. Benefits went up. Quality of life followed right behind it. I said, now, what happened in 1976 that brought all that to a screeching halt for the working class? And they didn't know. And I was surprised that they didn't know, because a few of these guys were in their 50s and 60s. They certainly were around then, and they should have known. A few of them were in their 30s, younger guys, especially the guy who was managing the Russian oligarch's fortunes. He was only about 35 years old and handling $100 billion in guys' money. I said, well, three things happened simultaneously in the mid-70s. One, the growth and expansion from corporate rating and greenmailing to junk bonds and the beginning of what evolved from the corporate raiders into the equity partnerships, where a group of people get together, they pool money. They then go to a friend on Wall Street like Goldman Sachs, and they say, we have a corporation, and it's doing very well. It's been around for 100 years. has 300 employees. It has a nice pension sitting there for those employees. It has no debt. And we believe that we could buy that by giving them $40 million. The company is worth $20 million. Well, if it's worth 20 and you could buy it for 20, why would you spend 40? Simple. 20 million goes to the people who own the company and their stockholders, but 20 million goes to the equity partnership as a bonus, as some form of fee. Well, where are you going to get all the money? Well, the equity partnership will put up 5 million and Goldman Sachs will cover the rest. And for covering all that money, Goldman Sachs gets 10% up front. So you're making 4 million cash immediately, plus you get non-reserve stock in the company. Meaning non-reserve, you don't have to hold it for a year or two before you can sell it. And you can pump it and dump it. You pump up the volume so you get everyone excited about the stock, and then when everyone buys high, you sell and you're out. Stock that cost you zero is now $20 or $100, whatever it is, you've made probably another $10 million. So Goldman Sachs makes out phenomenally well, and this is the beginning of the whole movement towards IPOs, investing in new startup businesses, and or taking over existing businesses. Now, there was a time when Macy's was the largest store in the world and one of the most profitable, and all these other corporations were very well run. People for almost 40 years ran companies in America. In fact, for longer than that, they ran them very conservatively. Why? I remember growing up in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where the wealthiest kids, a guy named Billy Meldrin, whose father ran the bank, Parkersburg National Bank, and Steve Haig, whose father was a lawyer for these major companies, and Jerry Goldberg, whose father ran the big store company, a furniture store, we all went to the same school. We were all buddies. If we were rich or poor, middle class, we were all friends. We attended the same churches. We same social events. There was no great ostentatious living. It was frowned upon. So you knew people had money because they went to Pittsburgh and shopped and you couldn't. You didn't get to any big cities, but they could. But they never drove something so outrageous in the way of a car. And their house was nice, but it wasn't some extravagant, over-the-top mansion. They didn't dress differently. So in effect, when we were playing softball, everyone was there. When there's a covered dish dinner at the church, everyone was there. So there's a sense that we're all community. Yeah, you have more money, but you're no brighter because you have more money. And some of those kids went to the private universities that were more expensive. The rest of us went to public schools because we couldn't afford it. But that was all right, because at that time, you weren't looked upon as being less than worthy because you went to a state university. You know, if you went to West Virginia University, or, you know, Huntington University, or any of the other universities, it was fine. You know, we didn't have this elitism. And a lot of us were very idealistic. We came out of the whole concept of ideals, character development. But then it all changed in the 1970s because these very conservatively run companies that prided themselves on having good pay for their workers, because back then, if you worked for a job, you were expected to work there the rest of your life. In fact, you were considered irresponsible if you had two jobs. So you had one job, and that was it. And your company took care of you. When you retired, you got a pension. And the company was a very important part of the community, and they would sponsor all kinds of events to help people. The YMCA and the Boys Club and the Girls Club, that's what these companies did. So there was never growing up a negative connotation with a company. It was always to the opposite, positive. You know, they would be there to help the Boy Scouts. And I was a Boy Scout leader. I was a Life Scout, and as a result, when you needed money for a jamboree for some of the poor kids, you'd go to a bank and say, Mr. Mildren, could you donate $5,000? Sure. You'd write a check, $5,000. Suddenly all these kids go. And it was understated in publicity, but everyone knew. These were good people. Even the soapbox derby, first in my city's history, I was in the first race, the first heat, and came in last. I had a big clunker of a soapbox, but it was fun. I'll never forget it. One of those joyful memories of my life. And so imagine that. So we had high union representation. We had good workers. We had living wages. We had salaries. And there was always some increase. And people look forward to this. All that changed when five individuals changed the course of American history. You won't hear any of them mentioned today by anyone on Wall Street. You won't hear any of the demonstrators saying, why don't we go back and re-look where we went wrong? The names, Michael Milken, the most powerful, wealthy person in the history of Wall Street up to that point. He made $1 billion in the 1970s at Drexel Burnham. And yet it wasn't enough to keep him honest. He dealt in insider trading, and he went to prison. Paid a $500 million fine. Two, Ivan Botsky. He also went to prison for insider trading. T. Boone Pickens, the same T. Boone Pickens today who's promoting, you know, gas around the country in those ads, and a corporate raider. And then Saul Steinberg, who had Reliance Insurance Group, and another guy who's still around today, Carl Icahn. Now, from buying companies to harass them, to get them to give you extra money to go away. It was called remailing. And then junk bonds, and then corporate raiding. You would raid a company. You would find the company was most vulnerable if you were run profitably, if you were run ethically, if you were run with real good management. You then became the victim because you were run too well. So what did companies do? They started taking what was called poison pills. They would load themselves up with debt, making themselves unattractive to a suitor. But if you had been a company that had run so perfectly, no debt, good working relationships, good pension funds, oh, you were a sitting duck. And then it began buying them, loading them with debt, stripping off their assets, because three things would happen in this order. First, you would pay far more for a company than what it was worth. But because now you control the company, you could take that extra money and give it to yourself as a bonus. So right up front, the guys who got in there made hundreds of millions of dollars in profit for themselves without ever a towel being sold or a pair of jeans being sold. Just the fact that you could manipulate how a company was purchased, you got rich. Secondly, this poor company that was profitable and well run, no company like that could hold the burden of all this excess financial debt, financial servicing. So you would start to downsize. You would sell off different divisions. Do you remember when Macy's was bought by Federated? Suddenly Macy's was almost bankrupt because Federated was almost bankrupt. Now I'll tell you a few companies that just went bankrupt that this happened to. Linens and things. Circuit City. Rings a bell for you? Yes. They were not poorly run. They were well-run companies. That was their problem. They were too well-run and made themselves vulnerable to being taken over by the guys on Wall Street who have no intention of running a company. They don't care about these companies. So from the 1970s, the mid-1970s, until today, the way you make money is you create what is known as an equity partnership, where people put up money, but only a small amount. And then they get a bridge loan from their buddies on Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and the other companies. And then they go in and buy a company, load it up with debt. But then something else started to happen. They found it was more profitable not to keep this company in America. Why in the heck should we be paying these people a living wage? They're making about $33 an hour when you add in health care and all the other expenses. What the heck are we doing? This is just stupid. Why don't we buy the company? First, we sell off its divisions that are profitable. And then we take this company and we go to China. Because if we can make bicycles in the United States in a small town in Connecticut that's been there for 100 years, where the cost of making a bicycle is $55. But the metal and all the equipment in that bike is only about $15. The rest of it is in labor. Why don't we make it in China where we can make that bike for $15? bring it back in the United States and sell it for $65. We will destroy the competition. If we can sell a bike in Walmart cheaper than what an American bike can actually be made, we dominate the marketplace. Brilliant. Great idea. And then it began. Bring in products that an American-made product couldn't compete with because we actually cared about the working American. At least we did for about 100 years. And then the group of the most powerful people, and don't say they were conservative and don't say they were liberal, neither of which is the case, they were corporatist. They were the big corporatists. These were the globalists, meaning we'll take a company here and outsource it to Haiti. We'll make baseballs in Haiti, which, by the way, became the baseball-making capital. Did you know that? Haiti made more softballs and baseballs than any other place in the world, yet you didn't see people playing baseball or softball in Haiti. Why? Because why pay an American labor union wage when you could get it made under slave labor in Haiti, for 15 cents an hour instead of $15 or $20 an hour? So that's how they first destroyed the American labor force, and then that's how outsourcing and corporate rating and globalization started to take hold. So that's when tens of thousands of corporations started to be bought. Then you had some people in corporations who realized, I don't want to be like my father and run this business and earn $50,000 or $100,000 a year and be respected by my community. This is stupid. I can sell out now, and we can use the pension funds of the workers as part of the sweetheart part of the deal, and they're going to give me $3 million, and I can take that $3 million. I can move to West Palm Beach. I can move anywhere and live a really great life. I'm tired of being in this city like Parkersburg. I want out of here. So the people who had been the stewards of these businesses that were the backbone of American manufacturing for over 100 years, they sold out their workers. They sold out their communities. And there were all these greedy people on Wall Street using other people's money to buy businesses without any thought. What are the consequences to the community, to their schools, to the restaurants, to the dry cleaners, to the softball league, to the workers, to their pensions, because frequently their pensions were stripped out and stolen also. Now, if you don't understand that part of American history, then you will not appreciate today that we've had in just the last 10 years 44,000 American corporations outsourced and closed down in America. They no longer exist. Now, I didn't say 44,000 workers. I said 44,000 manufacturing companies. Whole companies gone. And then when you drive through America, as I do, doing my new documentary, and there's no quick way to do it. There's no fly-in, fly-out. I have to take my car, and I have to load it up with equipment. I have to drive town to town. I have to spend a day or two or three in a town. And I have to look at all these empty old factories that surround the town. Then I have to find people that used to work in those factories. And I have to spend time with them, sitting and talking and letting them tell me their story about how that factory was there. Oh, it was there before I was born. And my granddaddy lived there and worked there. And then my father worked there and I worked there. And then one day we heard that this new people had taken it over. But it was good. It was going to help us. And then the next thing you know, we're told that they had to close down parts of it. And then we had to give back some of our wages. And then it got to be where there were no other jobs in town to take. And then we found we couldn't even keep up with our expenses. And then it just got worse. And then inflation came and the cost of everything was more expensive. The interest was expensive. Some of the farmers around here were paying 20% interest, and they didn't make 20%, so their farms were going broke. And we thought, why are they allowing this to happen? They control the interest rate. Why don't they bring it down? Why don't they forgive the farmers' late interest payments and save the American farmer? 3/4 of all American farms went bankrupt in under 10 years. So those are the stories I hear. And unless you hear them, unless you put a face on them, unless you have a story to learn from, the headlines don't tell it. And those who would spin all this to their advantage, never honest. It's the details. It's like when I ask a farmer, I'll help you all day today. I'm a farmer too. I'm a certified farmer. And they, where'd you go? Well, I grew up in West Virginia, and I've had a farm upstate out of New Paltz, and had one in Texas and Gene Autry's old place, and have one in Florida now. Suddenly there's something he and I have in common. What do you want to do that for? Well, I'd like to ask you questions, but I'm not going to interfere in you doing your work today, so I'd like to help you do the work, and in turn you could help me by telling me about what it's like to be your age today with the circumstances you're faced with and how you're coping. And that's how I get my stories. That's why when you watch a film of mine, that's what goes into it. My films are not about me. My films are about the people. So that's why I have another 2 months out on the road before I finish Poverty, Inc. In any case, now we had stagnant wages. And the second shoe to drop was the technology boom, where computers started to automate everything and make it easier, and therefore made a lot of jobs no longer necessary. And those great innovations, on the one hand, cost a lot of people their livelihoods. And then the third was that the major corporations saw the banks in particular and equity partnerships, and then the hedge funds, that why make money by owning a company? That's just stupid. Why worry about owning a farm where you got to, is it going to be drought or flooding, the cost of seeds, and there are going to be insects while I get it to market? Why not just trade in futures? Let's get into the commodities manipulation business. You don't have to buy an oil company. To trade the stock of oil, you can manipulate the price up, and then you make profit. Same with food, same with water. So privatization and speculation became the big advantage starting in the 80s and really, really manifesting further and further. Till now, 20% of all the profit made in the United States is made in the financial sector. And how do they make it? They make money from money gambling, not from putting money back into communities to support small businesses, homeowners, or new businesses. So unless you understand how we got to where we are today, where the average person's wages have been stale for the last 30 years, where over 30 million Americans have lost their jobs and had to find others because their companies where they once were gainfully employed and had money in their pocket are gone because of greed. So how in the world, I ask these men, how in the world do you expect there to ever be a recovery until you recover a living wage, where people have enough money to pay for what they need and pay for a mortgage or pay for rent, or and then have money left over to pay on clothes or whatever else they like, a car? Right now, the average American, 245 million Americans, don't have any extra money. They're living on debt. 1 week without a paycheck, and they're under the poverty level. So when I gave them this whole history lesson, which they seem clueless on, the responses were uniformly the same. It's not our concern what happens in the money market. I said, then you're assuming that everyone has the same amount of money to start, the same ability to make money, and therefore everyone is playing from the same level field. That's not the case. 85% of all people are adaptive, supportive life energies. They're not there to, you know, run the ball. They're not there to be the superstar. And they don't need to be rich. They just want to be respected and supported in their efforts to support those in their community. I said, you've disrupted the whole social contract. You've disenfranchised families. Anyhow, they got very uncomfortable with this conversation. And then, so they kind of broke up around 2 a.m. The next morning, I went out for a run, and only one guy joined me then, and it was the Japanese fella. And we did our run in silence, came back, and he was doing some meditation, and both of us did some meditation and yoga, and he sat there, and as we were looking out the ocean, he said, "I appreciate what you said to these people yesterday. You are correct, but they cannot acknowledge that, because you allowed them to see into the nature of what it is to resensitize yourself to your actions." And he was coming at it from a more Buddhist point of view, and he talked about how he only suggests investments for the money he manages that are ethical. And personally, he will not engage in any investment that causes harm to either the environment. And he was the only one of 22 of the world's top money managers. He was the only one who came from a very spiritual point of view. And he was completely different in his energy. It was very grounded. He was a vegetarian. He was very grounded. And I appreciated the fact I had a chance to get his perspective. And that didn't mean that the people he managed their money for were equally as grounded, no. But he was smart enough to make profits for them, and that's all they cared about. He said, "If I stop making profits for them, they will say goodbye to me in a heartbeat." So all this brings us full circle on this issue, and that is, if violence every day in video games and television and movies desensitizes us to the nature of violence, so therefore we no longer have the sympathy, the compassion for someone who is suffering, then does not that also desensitize us on many other levels? And then when you hear the harsh commentaries by Glenn Beck and the other people, well, if you're poor, it's because you're lazy. And then you realize American workers work 20% longer than any other worker in the world. We're the hardest working people in the world. We work more hours. We have less holidays. We have less vacations than anyone else in the world. And still we're exhausted because we're not making enough to make ends meet. So here's a question for you. Wouldn't it be more reasonable, more spiritual, more responsible for those people who run corporations and their board of directors to say, what would happen if we were to require less net profit to share with ourselves and our bonuses and our stockholders, but to show that we are increasing the living standards of our employees so that we increase our employees' wages and benefits, so they have more money to feel secure in what they're doing, and that resensitizes us to their needs? We'll still be profitable, but we won't be profitable on steroids. We won't have to go to the ends of the earth to find someone we can exploit at slave labor to make a garment that makes us more money than what otherwise we could have made had we made it by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in New York City. What would happen if that happened? It's merely a hypothesis. Would the stockholders say, you're naive and you're stupid, and the only reason I'm investing in your company is because how much net profit you make? We don't question how you make your profit. We don't care. We don't want to know. If you're using sweatshop labor and kids' labor in India to make us, you know, our skirts, don't tell us. Just show us the money. Show us the money. And Wall Street says, hey, we're not going to promote you. You're not going to be up on our board of suggestions if you become ethical and are less profitable. We'd rather have you less ethical and far more profitable. It's not even a discussion that's happening anywhere, nor even a suggestion that maybe it's a way that we could re-examine the position that we have in the workplace. You know, a little story, and sometimes I believe that we can learn things through stories, because how often is it in your life or my life where we have a chance to meet some of the people who are the people behind the scenes who move the money, place the money, and are doing so without any sensitivity to whether or not making the money for their clients causes a bad product to get on the market or a good product?